Once more unto the breach, dear friend, else fill the wall up with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, this week starring Jake McClure. Jeff is still out and recovering. He is doing much better. So if you have an interest in his health, please send him an email asking him to get better. His email is jeff@tpwc.com. So today is August 20th, 2016. And this is the Personal Wealth Coach, which is not just the program that you're hearing. It also happens to be a firm in Salado, Texas, that's registered with the SEC to give fiduciary investment advice. Now, what that means to you is not so big in that on the radio, I'm not giving advice. What I'll do is hopefully give education. So on from the part of me as your announcer, your hopefully educator and possibly annoyer. Thanks for listening. Okay, so what's happened this week? And this is usually the part where I start making fun of Jeff, my dad, when he's talking about what's happened this week. And I generally say it started with a Sunday. We have an argument over whether or not the week actually starts on a Sunday or a Monday. So just imagine that for a moment and you'll get a little nostalgia and then we can move on. Okay. What happened this week? Not much. As far as the market moves, the Standard & Poor's 500, that's the index that we watch the most, that most people watch the most, because it's a pretty good representation of what's happening in the overall market. It was down this week, but it was down by 0.01%. We had no movement or very little movement. It went from 2,183 to 2,185. And there's actually some fractional points in there that make it less than that. So it's just a point and a little bit of movement in the market. We had a lot of news come out, and yet the market barely moved. We didn't have a lot of volatility. This is a little unusual. And we can blame politics for that again. This is one of those weird things that never gets old, trying to interpret the market's moves, trying to say, is it rational or is it silly and emotional? And usually it's some kind of mix of both. So why didn't the market move more? We've had the NSA got hacked. We've got the political conversation has not gotten cleaner. There's still mud flinging in every direction. There's still people making promises that are in no way possible to be upheld in the political race on both sides. So what happened? Well, the poll numbers are in and we're getting some slight more certainty in the market, and not enough to cause the market to really run away and grow. But this is one of those pieces that it's hard to explain to people, except that deep down in the common sense level, most people understand it already. The things that we fear are the unknown. When we can tell our kids that there's no such thing as monsters, barring Sesame Street, Elmo is a monster and a sweet one at that, but there's no such thing as monsters, we can say that with utter truth because we've given names to everything. And none of them include monster. But if you were living in the Stone Age and you happened upon a crocodile, you might call it a monster. If you're living in the Bronze Age and you happen upon a giraffe, it's quite possible that you would consider that a monster. If you find dinosaur bones and you don't know what they are, it's a monster. So we have this big universal name that we apply to the unknown. Monster, scary. The market's the same way. As long as we know about something, any of us, and when I say we, I'm including all of the listeners, because if you live in America, you're part of the market. There's no single voice of Wall Street. That's a ludicrous idea. America is owned by Americans. Just hold that in your mind as an assumption going forward. It's an assumption that's very accurate. We own our economy. If you have a 401k, if you own your car, if you work, any of those things say that you not only own the economy, but you also benefit from the economy. Okay, so uncertainty is the enemy of business. We can plan for things that we know about. Anybody can. If you know about an event and you say this is likely to happen, you can plan for it. It's good for the economy. When we have a political election coming along and we don't know who's going to be elected, it's really easy to say this person or that person is going to be better for the economy. Or if you want to be truthful, it's really hard to say. It's easy to say it, but it's hard to be accurate. If Hillary Clinton is elected, there are potential bad things that could happen to the economy. If Donald Trump is elected, there are potential bad things that could happen to the economy. They're not the same bad things. They're unknowns because we don't know which one is going to be the lead. We don't know which one is going to be the one to plan for. Well, the polls this week have been pretty clear, and the week before, for that matter. Donald Trump is down in the polls. The economy doesn't respond to that, but the market does. The market has responded with less volatility than usual because there's some small amount of certainty coming back into the mix. It isn't that the market likes Hillary Clinton or that the market likes Donald Trump. The market has no emotion on its own, and this is something it's really hard for us to grasp. We want to make the anthropomorphism happen here. We want the market to have feelings. We want the market to think. We say, what does the market say about this? And the market seems to be saying this. Well, the market is no more saying anything than all of us together when we're asleep across the United States. What are we saying? Well, we're all saying something. Is it coming together into one voice? No. That only happens very rarely. In the market, we have this big auction going on all the time. And anyone thinks that the market is completely rational is wrong, in that if the market were completely rational, we wouldn't have the volatility that we have on a normal basis. People would say it's worth this, and therefore with new earnings, it's worth a little bit more. Now, on the other end, there's people that say that the market's completely random, completely irrational. If that were the case, then we wouldn't have a consistent upward trend through history, where people say it's worth more than it was based on some numbers. So the reality is that the market is a lot like any of us in that we're sometimes rational and sometimes not. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, enjoy the show and the newsletter. It seems like there's hundreds of indexes out there that are published every day.
Yeah.
I saw one in the Wall Street Journal. It's the Global Macro Surprises Index, which I've never heard of. two-part question. If you know anything about that, what is that? And for somebody that doesn't have a whole lot of time, is there like one or two or three indexes that we should be paying attention to if you have limited time to keep up with that stuff? Thank you. I'll hang up on this.
Okay. All right. That's a good question. Really, you have to understand what indexes are. And I've spent some time in the past going over that. Macro Surprises, that index, I'll hit that one first. That's a Morgan Stanley index. And they look at all of the big events in the world economy. That can be the Federal Open Market Committee, otherwise known as the Fed. It can be decisions made in Germany or Spain that are known, the European Central Bank's moves, big fiscal changes, changes in big trade. And what's funny about this particular index is it's supposed to be looking for surprises before they happen. And there's a problem with that. It's a bit of an oxymoron. The definition of surprise means you didn't know about it before it happened. So the efficacy of that particular index has not been well proven. It is a nice thing to be measuring the big events that happened. I would rather call it the macro global index rather than the macro surprises index. Because it's a nice one to show things that are happening on a regular basis that we know about. But to call it surprises just makes what I just said make no sense. It's things that we know about on a regular basis. Okay, so put that to the side. It's a relatively new index. There are indexes coming out all the time. What are indexes? This is an even better one. So if you want an index to watch, I'm going to do a sidetrack into the complexity of academia here. There is something statistically called R squared, where you take a portfolio and you measure the movements of that portfolio against different indexes. And the one that most highly correlates, the highest R squared, is the index you should be watching. For some reason, most people don't calculate their R squared. The reason being that it's a complex task, and most people don't even know that it's something you can do. Okay, so what index should we be watching? What is an index? An index is an arbitrary group of stocks that are measured most of the time without any transaction fees and without dividends. So what's the purpose of it? It doesn't seem like that would be an accurate gauge of anybody's actual investments. The purpose of indexes is very, very simple. The purpose of indexes is to sell newspapers. Then that sounds like I just went off on a conspiracy theory. I didn't. Standard & Poor's owns now the Dow Jones indexes. It also owns the S&P 500. Bloomberg owns the Bloomberg indexes. Most, and by most, I mean the absolute vast majority of indexes, and my dad likes to call indices. I'm not sure which one you would prefer. I like indexes. Most of them are owned by newspapers. And you really can't call them papers anymore. News electronics. News organizations own indexes. Why? Because the original indexes were designed by the Dow Jones Company, by Dow. He put it together before the Wall Street Journal was born, and said, it was back when the Wall Street Journal was a newsletter, and it had a bunch of stock movements in the back, hundreds of stocks moving up and down. Now we have hundreds of indexes. And he said, in order to give a front line, a headline, something that says what's happened amongst all those stocks, we have to have some kind of an average of movement to say what the market did. The reason why we use the S&P 500 is because it owns roughly, it doesn't own, it holds in its calculations roughly 500 relatively large companies that are pretty representative of the stock market as a whole. So I like the S&P 500. If you are in a position where you're invested in stocks, it's a pretty good place to be looking. But most people don't just have stocks in their portfolio. Most people have some stocks and some bonds, which means that you have to start looking at multiple indexes if you want to have a good representation of what's happening to your portfolio. An easier way to find out what's happening with your portfolio is to look at your portfolio. Look at the bottom line of there and graph it out. Most people don't want to do that either. So there's graphing programs and graphs that come with the statements, and you can compare them against indexes. But what you need to know at the very beginning is that your portfolio, unless it is all in an index fund, is not going to be well represented by any single index. Indexes are created so that newspapers can have a frontline event. Most people are not represented by any single index. I like the bigger ones. Even the Russell 3000, which is a much larger number of stocks. But what we find is that the more stocks you have, the bigger companies still run the index. Walmart has a much larger impact on the S&P 500 than the 499th smallest or largest company out at the very end there. We don't even know the name of it because it's that small and we don't hold 500 company names in our head at any given time. So indexes are one of those assumptions about the market that it's, I think, very important to understand at the very beginning before you're involved in the market. And if you're already involved, then understanding it now is important. when someone says that the S&P 500 is breaking records, which has been happening lately, does that mean that your portfolio is breaking records? Not necessarily. If you're taking a withdrawal out of there and it's higher than the market's moved, then you're going to be lower than you were at the last S&P 500 record. There's a lot of other factors that fit into this. So understanding how your portfolio fits is a conversation you need to either have with yourself and to understand in great detail what it is that you need to be following to make sure you're keeping up with the averages, or a conversation you have with your advisor to say, which index should I be watching? And if they don't know, or if they say, well, I think kind of this or that, then they need to either explain why they don't know. Is your index that strange? Or is your portfolio that strange? Or explain why they don't know because they don't understand indexes, which is a dangerous situation to begin with. Okay, so coming back to the following indexes, it really is good. We report on this program on the S&P 500 regularly. We talk about other big macro events. One of the problems with macro events, though, is that we're looking at averages of averages of averages, and that's dangerous. When we talk about inflation and we say over the last several years we've had almost no inflation, we've had a little deflation, we're coming up on possibly some inflation. And yet there are people in my listening audience that hear that and go, wait a minute, I'm on a fixed income and my expenses have been going up and they don't have anything to do with me buying more expensive types of item. The item I'm buying has become more expensive. So when we do averages of averages, a lot of times when we talk about the consumer price index, or if people are in a hurry, they say the CPI to measure inflation. And then they say a basket of goods. And it's funny because you never actually see the basket. They keep calling it a basket of goods, but why don't they call it a bucket or something? And that's a silly side shoot, but I think it's kind of a valid question. This group of goods generally excludes some of the items that move around the most, like food and energy. Well, why does inflation exclude food and energy? Well, there's something most of us know at a common sense level that we tend to forget when we're talking about sophisticated items. Sometimes when we start talking about sophisticated items, we lose our common sense. So let's grab it back. When are tomatoes available? In a garden. Not at the grocery store. In a garden. You're starting to get it. Tomatoes are available in your garden in summer. Sometimes you can have a bumper crop. You can have more than one crop of tomatoes. Well, if you're at the grocery store, what you'll notice is in the summer, tomatoes are less expensive. Does that have to do with some big economic impact of trade or laws or taxes? Or no, that's when tomatoes grow. Well, there are other tomatoes that grow. They grow not in summer. We've got greenhouse vegetables, fruit. The tomatoes are fruit, and there's a great joke that comes with that one. Intelligence is knowing that tomatoes are fruit. Wisdom is knowing not to put it in a fruit salad. Okay. We take a lot of tomatoes from South America, and they take a lot of money from us for those tomatoes. In the process of that exchange, there are ships or airplanes involved. Suddenly the tomato gets more expensive because it's got to take a ride on an airplane. And if you have a choice between driving to Austin from Temple or taking an airplane to Austin from Temple, the price tag tends to be higher for the airplane. It's a pretty simple calculation. You can throw that in there. Well, that throws the inflation numbers completely off because suddenly we're having these big spikes of inflation in the tomato world in the middle of winter. When we talk about a basket of goods, we're trying to say, how do we keep that basket understandable? When you hear about these big bureaucracies that are seasonally adjusting things. Now, I tend to seasonally adjust my dinner before I eat it, but what they're talking about is the season of the year. It's the same word. seasons that you use on your food get that word, that name, because they were generally only available in specific seasons because they were plants. So keep that in mind. Seasonally adjustment meant that in some parts of the year, you didn't have garlic to put in your food, and some, unless you had a root cellar, and then the garlic was not so good as it was before, and we learned about drying them. We learned about a lot of things. The spice roads were not running in parts of the year. Now we're in a much more global economy. We're in a much quicker economy, and people tend to forget the things that we know about gardens. We tend to forget the things that we know about our individual portfolios. So back to indexes. And I want to go back to trade because I had planned on talking about that during this episode. The garden and your portfolio make a lot of sense together. And it may come into fruition at different times than the overall market, depending on what you have in your garden. Depending on what you have in your portfolio, what's growing? Why are you growing it? If you're growing one crop, well, you better be careful with that crop, because all it takes is one disease, one worm, or one type of bug to come in and wipe it out. That's diversification, and we're lacking diversification in a lot of our agriculture right now because of new technologies that have said, let's make plants more resistant to things. There are these great boons, but there is also a danger associated with that. Lack of diversification, no matter how safe that item is a danger. Does that mean we need to immediately stop growing Monsanto corn? Probably not. But the marketplace is going to come up with an alternative over time. And it's already started. I mean, farmers markets are a big trendy item. When in my childhood, if somebody had said, let's go be cool and hang out at the farmers market, everybody would have laughed at them. So the market is coming up with a solution to diversification in corn or in tomatoes. You're not getting the only one kind of tomato in the grocery store, and the grocery store is reacting to the demand that they see in the farmers markets. This, you're starting to begin to understand the complexity of the economy. When we're trying to measure these things, we know we're making errors. It has to be there. The errors have to exist in order to seasonally adjust for the price of tomatoes. We know that in that season, the numbers don't match the seasonal adjustment. And the economists are constantly trying to get it right. Those calculations have to change with new technologies. If we didn't seasonally adjust, then the unemployment rate at the beginning of the school year goes through the roof, because kids are not continuing their job when they go back to school. So we seasonally adjust. And when you look at the beginning of summer, some politician needs to get a lot of credit, because suddenly hiring is happening at a massive rate. All these people that weren't even in the workforce are back in the workforce. We know what that is. So when you're doing a measurement, first you start with what you know. If you know the beginning length of a board and you've only added a certain additional length, you don't have to measure the whole thing. That's the concept in economics. It's one of the reasons why we as humans get better every generation at what we do, is because we can learn from the generation before. Economics is only just recently becoming a science. Up till very recently, it has been, how do we measure stuff? And can we predict stuff with this measurement? Well, most of the time it was no, you can't predict it, but you've measured it very well. Good job. Well, we're getting to the point where we have gathered enough data that when a politician raises taxes in certain environments, that's generally a bad thing. When they lower taxes in other environments, that could generally be a bad thing too. So recognizing the environment that an economy is in is as important as what season it is when you start planting your tomatoes. You have to understand what's going on right now in order to understand if there's any amount of success to be expected by planting those tomatoes. This is a concept we all understand. And again, once things get sophisticated, people think the common sense that we all know goes out the window. It doesn't. Economics is the ultimate in common sense, because you don't buy things flippantly most of the time, though there are some, there's some data that says some of us do. There's the big gorillas that hang up above or stand up on top of the used car lots, the big inflatable purple gorillas. I've gotten the chance to look at the books of multiple car dealerships and mark out with a highlighter the times when the big gorilla is above it. And surprisingly, or not surprisingly, knowing human nature, the gorilla attracts sales, and in large quantities. People, for some reason, believe that gorillas are a harbinger of really good car buying times. So keep that in mind. If you're planning on buying a car, don't do it because of the hot dogs. Don't do it because of the free balloon or the gorilla. Make your decision before you show up on the lot. Now, will you actually take that advice? On the whole, averaged across all of the listeners, probably not. But some of you will. And those some of you that will, that say, I'm going to buy a car, I'm going to do my research, I'm going to make my decision before I get on the lot, tend to get a lot better deals out of buying a car than the people that show up for the gorilla or the hot dogs or the balloon. This, you know, this sounds like I'm going off track from what is an index. It isn't really. I'm still answering that same question. What is an index? Why should we watch it? Find the index that most closely matches what you have. There's a lot of indexes out there. Why do you even need an index? Well, you need an index to say, am I performing up to the standard that I set for myself? If you go to an advisor and you say, I'm afraid of taking risks, and but I want to get in the market and I want to get some amount of return, then that advisor hopefully is going to put you in a really conservative portfolio. You'll be in the market, but you're going to have hopefully a lot less movement up and down than the other things. And if you turn and you're looking at the S&P 500, that's a recipe for sadness. Because you're going to look at that index and you're going to say, I never beat that index, or when I do, it's for just the short period of time, and then in the next 5 years, the index beats me every time. Well, it's because that index doesn't represent you at all. If you take the parts of your portfolio that are in that index, that part should be at least keeping up. Not always, because some of those pieces are very conservative. But that's the concept. Okay, so we've covered some things this morning that I was planning on doing anyway. I'm going to come back and talk about some trade issues very soon, right after the commercials. I think it's vital that we understand it, because both parties right now in the political election are talking about trade in a way that is unrealistic. Let's not get blinded by the big purple gorillas. Let's look at the reality of the situation and make our best judgment based on data and based on what we think is going to be best for our country, not based on promises that, if anybody does any research, are not possible. So let's look at the trade issues, let's look at the economic plans, and I'll be doing that in just a minute. In the meantime, speaking of trade, Town Square Media needs to support itself. The KTEM 1400 does not run for free, so we've got some commercials that need to be played. So when I return from the commercials, we'll talk about trade. We'll talk about the economic plans of both of the major candidates right now. Until we get back, if you would like to call, by the way, during the break, the number in here to call is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back. And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. The number in here to call is 254-773-1400. I promised I would talk a bit about trade. I said I was going to talk about the economic policies of the two major candidates. So in order to begin that, I'm going to take the analogy we were talking about earlier with tomatoes. I'm going to spread it out a little bit. It's not really an analogy, because it is direct trade we're talking about there. It's an example. And I know I was using it as an analogy to talk about the market, but it really isn't, because it's part of the market. So in order to understand the big market, you have to start at the small level and then grow. So tomatoes are pretty small. Well, let's talk about oil. Oil prices are pretty low right now. They've been pretty low for a couple of years now. Although people, when I mention that it's been a couple of years, they get surprised and they say, really? How has it been a couple of years? It just happened. Well, it's a big event and it doesn't happen very often. So we tend to think of it as more recent than it was. So oil prices are down. They're hovering in the between the low 40s and the mid 40s per barrel, which is a really weird way of measuring it for your common person. A common person does not go out and buy a 33-gallon barrel of oil and then refine it. But it's a good indicator for what's going to happen in the refining process and what the price of gasoline is going to be out on the other end. And that's something we see more often. But we can also use that oil price as an indicator for other prices. Natural gas prices are not always correlated, but they're pretty close most of the time. So when the prices are down on energy, well, that affects inflation. What's caused the price of oil to be low for this period of time here? And most of us know that. We've got a new technology, fracking. We've got a bunch of new oil available to get that was unavailable before. We've got a price war amongst a lot of countries out there to see how low they can go and still make a profit. Venezuela's not doing so well. There are Saudi Arabia is running into some issues. The sovereign wealth funds that we've talked about in the past, these big, huge governmental piles of cash that have been used in the past several years, past decade, to shift markets and to kind of bully people around with investing. They are shrinking rapidly because those sovereign wealth funds belong to places like Venezuela and Russia and Saudi Arabia, whose vast majority of their tax revenue came from oil. They were not really taxing their own citizens. They were taxing the companies that were getting the oil and selling it. Alaska does the same thing, and you'll see Alaska's been having some budget issues. They're stopping the universal check that gets sent out to every citizen of Alaska. And yes, that actually happens. Alaskans get checks just for being alive because the state has been charging more taxes than it should have. It doesn't make sense to do that, but it's kind of nice if you're a voter there. Hey, I get a free check. It's one of the dangers of democracy in that it can impede business. And at times when people get used to that kind of check, you have, in the case of Alaska, a lot of unhappy people that aren't getting that check. In the case of Venezuela, anarchy. No tomatoes on the shelves. And using tomatoes again, that's one that's very valid. Okay, so oil, back in October of 2014, in the United States, there's an oil rig count that we watch. And it peaked out at 1,609 oil rigs in active use just about 2 years ago. Well, that's the reason why the price is down right now. How many oil rigs are active right now? 406. But that's a rise over the past 3 months of 28%. So even with that rise, we're a quarter of the number of rigs that were in existence and being actively used in October of 2014. Well, it sounds like there's been this massive collapse in oil companies. There's been a small collapse in oil companies, but technology has been advancing through the middle of that. One oil rig today does what two did in 2014. So if it's a new rig, which is not all the rigs are new, but about a third of them are, we can add that up and we see that we've got a pretty good number of rigs out there. What does that have to do with trade? We want to sell that oil. We've got more oil now than we're using. This is great. The United States has been talking about doing this for a long time, energy independence. You notice that that's missing from the political rhetoric today. Energy independence is very important. Well, we're energy independent. We still import some oil because the way our market works is that you don't get your oil all from one source, and all the companies that make oil mix their oil together when they refine it. People in Saudi Arabia burn gasoline in their cars that was refined in Houston, Texas. because the refining capacity of Saudi Arabia is not very big. That's an import. And then we turn around and sell it as an American company for profit overseas. This is trade. Both political parties have been talking a lot about NAFTA as if it's a really bad thing lately. NAFTA, the North America Free Trade Agreement. It's an agreement between Canada, the United States, and Mexico, and it's spread out with other trade agreements to include a lot more of South America. And Trump says that it's cost us a lot of jobs. Occasionally, Clinton says the same thing, even though her husband is the one that signed it. He wasn't the first president to sign it, by the way. George H.W. Bush signed it as its preliminary form. And then the Republicans pushed for it and got it back. And then Bill Clinton didn't fight him on it. He signed it. So let's deal with an assumption issue here. And this is a fun one to deal with because it deals a lot of people get upset when we start the conversation. All right. What was the last president that had a balanced budget? Well, it was Bill Clinton. There's some fallacies in that question. We've got an answer, and it seems obvious. Well, Bill Clinton was the last president who had a budget that was balanced. Great. Who sets the budget? Well, not Bill Clinton, not Barack Obama, not George W. Bush. If you look back at the budgetary process, back in 1921, Congress got tired of being blamed constantly by the president for the debts. This is right after World War I. We went into a lot of debt while fighting World War I. And Congress didn't like that the president was turning and pointing at Congress and saying, look at all their spending. So in 1921, they passed a bill that looked like it was a great deal for the executive branch. They get to get together and summarize what they believe their budget should be for the next year and present it to Congress. And like I said, that sounds great. It sounds like we've just got a great issue. If the FBI says I want this budget, the Army says I want this budget, and it comes together and the president hands the budget over to Congress. Well, in the past 10 years, if you just go back and look at this, Congress doesn't accept that president's budget. And it's very rare in history since 1921 for Congress to say, oh yeah, that makes sense, I'm going to give up all of my power and say, yeah, the president's got all the budgetary control. That doesn't happen. So to blame spending on the president is a very common political rhetoric. Obama did it against Bush. Bush did it against Clinton. Clinton did it against Bush. I mean, you just go back and back and back. It's this great easy one-shot line, then everybody kind of nods their head and goes, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's silly. Just like the president doesn't have a whole lot of control of the economy. To say this president has led us through an economy of great, well, let's give the credit where it's due. Credit where it's due is that hopefully the president hasn't bungled anything horribly, and so therefore the economy's done well. Let's give the credit to the American public. To the people that create business. That's who's making the economy good. One of the things that we've talked about for a long time is the economy is poised to do a big jump in the very near future. We've got all this pent-up demand. We've got all this pent-up cash. We've got all of these people waiting to purchase things, houses being the biggest part of that. And they're waiting right now because of political uncertainty. Whomever is elected is going to get to take credit for the economy. Keep in mind that it's not the case, that it isn't the president's fault that you went out and bought a house. It isn't the Federal Reserve's fault that you decided to take money out of the market to buy a boat. That's why when people say the market is completely rational, I say it is, but not for the reason you think. People aren't making the decisions based on the Federal Reserve. They're making decisions based on long-term plans. They wanted to buy a boat at this point in their life. It's some combination of all of that. And when we're talking about trade, this is an area that the president does have a lot of control. And that's why I want to talk about it. We're kind of almost out of time to talk about it this hour. I'm going to run some more commercials, and we must be a popular group because there's a lot of commercials to run. We don't endorse the commercials, just as a side note. And a lot of the commercials, we just flat out don't agree with, and I'll let you figure those out as they come up. Most of you that have been listening for very long don't have any problem figuring it out. So if you'd like to call in, the number in here is 773-1400. That's 254-773-1400. And I'll be back on the other side of these commercials. All right, I'm back. I was talking about NAFTA. I was talking about oil prices. We talked about oil rigs. I'm going to get to NAFTA more in just a minute. Okay, oil prices are coming up. They're about $48 a barrel right now. That's an increase of $8 over the last couple of months. And it's kind of wavers up and down there. But I just said that the oil rig count is up. What that says, one, with the new technology for oil rigs, and two, with that slight increase in the price of oil, is that the people that are pumping the oil, the ones that are drilling, the ones that are fracking, are very aware of what the profit centers are. When the oil price is at the right point, they can put new rigs in and pump and make a profit. Once they've got the rig in, the front end cost is taken care of, and now they're just the ongoing cost of just running the rig, which is not incredibly high. That tells me that there's a relatively permanent cap, relatively being in the next 40 or 50 years, on the price of oil. We might have some spikes in that time period, but we just knocked out all of the oil companies that didn't care about profit, that just threw money at it because they thought the price was going to be at $150 a barrel forever. Venezuela is a direct example of that, but there were a lot of wildcatter firms in the United States that thought they were the only ones out there drilling for new oil at that high price, just like in the gold rush period, just not that long ago, and all the way back to the 1849 time period. People thought they'd go out and break it rich, hit it rich by hitting this great load of gold, and everybody else is doing it. The price of gold dropped. The price of oil has recently dropped. The price of gold has come back up. So expect to see more people going out to mine it, which is going to bring the price back down. The long-term effect of commodity prices is supply and demand. The supply side is regulated at least partially by technology. And the demand side is, what do we use it for? Man, I'm not going to have time to really touch NAFTA this hour. I'm going to spend some time on it. It's definitely worth the conversation, because we hear the rhetoric in the political world about losing jobs to people overseas or losing jobs to Mexico or Canada through NAFTA. And there have been some pretty outrageous claims that by renegotiating we can get a whole bunch of jobs back. I'm going to hit on those subjects, and I'm going to go at a place where you can understand what the agreement actually is, not the rhetoric behind it, but the reality of this agreement for free trade. And it covers a lot more than people think it does. It's pretty vital for the welfare of all the countries involved, at least at the minor level. The way we respect each other's laws, the way we respect each other's intellectual property, we'll get into that more. It's all based on an agreement that we had that includes trade. And negotiations in an international agreement are always complex. So it's easy to take the complexity of negotiations and use one piece of it as a negative against the entire. So I'll be talking about that next hour. If you would like to contact me or Jeff off the air, there's a voicemail during the weekend, and real people answer during the week, during business hours. The local phone number is 254-947-1111. And toll-free, it's 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email me directly at jake@tpwc.com, as in thepersonalwealthcoach.com. Ask me questions. It's great fodder for the next program. I really do read those. If you want to talk to Jeff, it's jeff@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage and listen to podcasts. You can read our philosophy and our newsletters. We had a caller who says he's enjoyed the newsletter. I recommend it. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Truth, It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.